Welcome back to the Philosophy Exchange podcast. My name is Johanna, and I'm here with Bennett Knox from the University of Utah and Nina De Boer from the
Radboud University of Nijmegen.
We're introducing a new mini-series on philosophy of psychiatry, and in the series we'll discuss the work of one PhD student working in the area of philosophy of psychiatry. And today we're starting with Bennett. Welcome, both of you, to the podcast.
Hello.
Hi.
So as I said, we're starting with Bennett's work. Bennett has written a paper about conceptualizing psychopathology or psychopathological concepts and the exclusion of the people who are being pathologized. And we'll talk a little bit about this paper, which is actually a forthcoming paper in the Philosophy, Psychiatry and Psychology Journal, should be coming out in the December edition, as far as I'm aware. And the paper is also... won the Carl Jasper Award from the AAPP, which I should tell you congratulations for.
Thank you.
Why don't you just take it away with a short summary of what the paper is about, introducing us and the listener to your paper.
All right. Well, first of all, thank you very much for having me on the podcast. I'm really excited about this whole series and getting to know some more people working in philosophy of psychiatry. So I thought I would sort of summarize the paper by way of telling the story of how I came to write it. So this paper sort of started off as a couple of different term papers that I wrote about psychiatry in my first year as a PhD student at Utah. And the first one was for a seminar about objectivity, a sort of philosophy of science seminar about different conceptions of objectivity in philosophy of science. And so I wrote a paper about, okay, what is the sort of the concept of objectivity that we should be using in psychiatric science? And in that context, I came to the conclusion that these versions of objectivity that sort of define objectivity in terms of value freedom or some sort of like absence of values in the scientific process was just not going to work in psychiatry, and that we needed an alternative conception of objectivity. And I discovered the work of Anne-Marie Gagné-Julien, who I cite heavily in this paper, and who actually was the winner of the Carl Jaspers Award the year before me. And her work is fantastic. She's written extensively about what she calls the social objectivity concept in psychiatry. So that was the first part. And then the next semester, I was in a different class about social epistemology. And in that context, I was thinking a lot about epistemic injustice, sort of injustice that's done to people in their capacity as knowers, and how that sort of plays out in psychiatry. And saw that there's a decent amount of literature about sort of one form of epistemic injustice, testimonial injustice, which is sort of when people do not have their testimony taken seriously or taken appropriately seriously due to sort of social factors. And there's sort of a growing literature in philosophy of psychiatry about how this plays out in psychiatric contexts, where people who are diagnosed with mental disorders or what have you don't have their testimony taken as seriously as maybe it should be. And I think that's very important, but there's sort of less literature on the second version of epistemic injustice, the hermeneutical version of epistemic injustice, where sort of, which has more to do with the concepts that people have at their disposal. And so I wanted to sort of explore that area of the epistemic injustice literature in the psychiatric context. And I actually sort of thought to put these two pieces together when I attended the AAPP session. It was online because this was in 2020 to 2021. I saw Anne-Marie give her talk about her Jaspers paper, where she defends this sort of this social concept of objectivity, and asked her a question about, hey, seems like epistemic injustice and sort of the exclusion of the people who are being diagnosed might present sort of an obstacle to this social concept of objectivity that she was pushing for in psychiatry. So, I mean, the upshot of the paper basically is it's about the revision process for the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the DSM. And there's been a lot, there's been a lot written about sort of arguing that patients need to have their perspectives included in this process. But a lot of that literature has focused on sort of moral and ethical and political reasons why we should include the people who are being diagnosed in the DSM revision process. And I think those are important concerns, but there's been less written about sort of epistemic reasons to include these people. And sort of if we take this social concept of objectivity seriously, one of the things that's necessary for it is to have an inclusion of a wide range of different normative perspectives in the process, and particularly those who sort of have a stake in the outcome of the process, like, you know, people who are diagnosed with mental disorders. And so I'm arguing that in order for psychiatry to be objective in this social sense, it needs to include these perspectives, take them seriously. And even the ones that psychiatrists sort of view as even hostile to psychiatry, things like perspectives of the neurodiversity movement, the Mad Pride movement, things like this. So that's sort of the upshot of the paper.
Can I briefly come in to say that I really enjoyed reading the paper, and that I think it's very important that these things are being spelled out more, because there's indeed, I feel, this a call for and this increasing urge that you hear, or that's is increasingly acknowledged, that there's a lot of voices that are not being heard in the sort of quote unquote professional discourse about psychiatry, and that it's really important for us to see how they can be added to this discourse and what kind of potential and also possibilities it may bring, rather than it only being an issue and a struggle as it is often put forward. So I wanted to briefly chip in and say that I really enjoyed reading it, and that I think it's really important work to say.
Thank you.
Yeah,
I appreciate that.
I definitely agree, which is also like the reason why I'm really excited that you agreed to come onto the miniseries, because I was going to ask you later, but I'm going to do this now, or like bring this up. This there's always a question like, what can philosophy do for the sciences? And I thought, like, reading your paper and also listening to your talk earlier at the Philosophy Exchange conference, I was like, okay, this work is so obviously helpful and needed. Like, people like the psychiatrists or like the researchers themselves don't have the time or the money to think about these higher conceptual issues, and not the capacities to look as deep into the literature and philosophy. And your work, I think, is doing some really important task here.
Thanks. No, I really appreciate that, because that's really what I aim for. Like, I really want my work to be philosophically rigorous, but also relevant to practicing psychiatrists, to people who are making decisions like decisions in the DSM revision. Because otherwise, I feel like we're just, you know, philosophers pondering things in our ivory tower. And I want my work to be more engaged than that.
Yeah, I was just wondering if I could like chip in on this, because indeed I agree with like what you say, that it should indeed be then like relevant to the psychiatrist and be of importance, for that the work that we do should be relevant for like psychiatrists, but also people with lived experience or the psychopathologized, as you refer to the group in your article. And there was something that I was wondering when reading, and maybe something you can elaborate on a bit, is like how you see the specific experience of the psychopathologized or the people with lived experience, because it's people with a lot of different stories, different backgrounds, different ideals, etc., that come in and that bring different things to the table potentially. So do you have like any thoughts or ideas on what sort of the specific knowledge maybe is that people with lived experience bring in that maybe psychiatrists do not, or to a lesser extent, bring in?
Yeah, thank you. So I'll just first briefly, the word you used, the psychopathologized word, which is one that I use in the paper. I think if I wrote the paper again, I might have used the word psychiatrized, just because I think that is becoming more common, like as a term that people are using to refer to themselves. But the basic idea is like there's all this, there's a whole bunch of literature about how to refer to whatever it is this population is that we're talking about, people with like lived experience of this type of mental disorder or neurodivergences, or people refer to this in many different ways. And I wanted to find because many of these terms, either they sort of don't really refer to the like the full spectrum of the community. They only, like, for instance, patient just implies someone who actually has sought out or undergone psychiatric care, which, you know, we might think that there's like a broader community of people who've had sort of experiences of mental illnesses who haven't undergone treatment, who aren't patients in that sense. And on the other hand, there are sort of other terms that sort of build in sort of assumptions, like, okay, people with mental disorders implies that those people in fact do have a mental disorder, which some of these people, you know, especially those with sort of more non-traditional conceptualizations of their experience, like they don't understand themselves as having a mental disorder. And yet I still want to be able to say that those people should be included in this process. So that was what the sort of the work that this term, the psychopathologized, is supposed to do. Roughly, it just means people who psychiatrists and or society would see as having a psychopathology, a mental disorder, whether or not they in fact do. So like the illustrative example that I use in like a footnote of the paper is, before homosexuality was removed from the DSM, which happened, we're coming up on 50 years ago, like before that, all homosexuals counted as psychopathologized in my sense. Like they were people who psychiatry understood as having a psychopathology, even though now we can look back and say those people never had a psychopathology in the first place. And that's the general medical consensus. Mm-hmm. But still, they had this experience of being treated as having a mental disorder. And I think I was sort of thinking about things in the terms of standpoint epistemology, mm-hmm. And sort of trying to narrow down, okay, what is the particular standpoint that I'm thinking about here? And I think that term sort of refers to roughly the group that I'm trying to capture. Because I think, and there's a good deal of literature now about sort of lived experience and the value of having that in scientific processes like psychiatric research, sort of expertise by experience. I think what I wanted to zero in on is the conceptual bit, because I think part of what is really valuable about, you know, what sort of knowledge we get from these types of standpoints is sort of knowledge about the holes in our mainstream concepts, the gaps in those concepts, where sort of those concepts fail to really capture the experience of people who have this lived experience. Mm-hmm. And I think that is precisely what's going on in things like the neurodiversity movement, or the example that I use in the paper is the hearing voices movement. These are people who, you know, hear voices that other people do not hear, and they understand their experience not as a mental disorder necessarily, some of them may, mm-hmm. but as a meaningful experience that they interpret for themselves and together with this group. And that seems to me like, here's a group of people within this sort of psychopathologized standpoint, and they can see the gaps in the concepts of psychiatry, the pathologizing concepts of psychiatry. And they have experiences that they think don't really fit into those concepts. And that allows them to develop, you know, and to develop these concepts, which I think psychiatry at the very least has to take seriously and give some uptake to. And if we're just going to exclude those sort of like alternative understandings of these experiences just from the get-go without even considering them, that seems to me like it's clearly going to be to epistemic detriment of the scientific process.
So then it's that people can shed light, or that the experts by experience can shed light on these different types of understanding or these different conceptions that maybe psychiatrists alone in a room wouldn't be able to sort of envision, that those were also alternate possibilities.
Yeah, I think that's roughly the idea.
Could you talk a little bit about the reception of your work from your colleagues? Because I remember at the Philosophy Exchange conference where we met in October, there was a bit of a discussion like, okay, this is all fair and good, but like, how would you actually do this? Like, how does this work in practice? Is this something that people bring up a lot? Or like, are there any other concerns?
Yeah, I mean, I will say, like, there's still a lot of work to be done, definitely. I think there's been differential uptake amongst different communities. I mean, I think, you know, I gave the presentation of this paper at the AAPP meeting, which it seemed like, I mean, it's not as though people just were totally on board. People had sort of objections and responses and whatnot, but people at least took what I had to say quite seriously. And even psychiatrists who were in the room took what I had to say seriously. I mean, the committee that decided to give me the award was, you know, had many psychiatrists on it, which, you know, I was a little surprised. I mean, I was surprised when they gave me this award in general, but I was also like, oh, like the psychiatrists actually, they're like, some of them are listening to me. Okay. Like clearly they thought this was valuable enough to give it an award. Okay. I mean, on the other side though, like, I'm less confident that the people who have power over the DSM process are likely to listen to someone like me. So I sort of frame the paper as a response to this piece that Robert Spitzer wrote. He was the chair of the DSM-3 task force, the DSM-3, which came out in 1980. And he's sort of like one of the major figures in 20th century psychiatry. And he wrote this piece, which he aptly titled Good Idea or Politically Correct Nonsense, in response to a call for patient inclusion in the DSM-5 process. And I mean, he clearly thought that it was politically correct nonsense, and has this sort of, in a way, it was kind of a blessing to like have this piece, because it's like a one-page piece. And he just like lays out everything I wanted to argue against, like over the course of one page. So in a way, like it was a blessing to me to find this. And this is one of the leading figures in 20th century psychiatry who was clearly actively hostile to including any patient perspectives. And certainly he would reject, you know, including neurodiversity advocates, mad pride advocates, that type of thing. And so I would like to think that things are better now than they were in 2004 when he wrote that piece, but I have less confidence that sort of the powers that be are going to listen to someone like me.
Yeah, I think something that I was thinking while reading sort of related to this is that it's also sort of this like dominant perspective has a lot of power and a lot of say, and in that way, difficult to, for like sort of the like elite psychiatrists or the ones who are involved in this process to sort of talk to the marginalized groups in this discussion. And that was also like something that I was wondering in that respect, that also the perspectives they sort of reason from are really different if you speak for, like, if you have someone who's very invested and like personally invested in the DSM, because that's sort of their like life's work, and they're in the task forces who are responsible for setting this up. And then you have people who are maybe like very critical of the psychiatric system and would argue for abolishing the system, etc. Mm-hmm. And there is a way in which you would ideally want them to sort of come together, or to at least sort of be in a shared space so that something else can come out of it. But if there's very extreme positions on either side, like, is there then still sort of any overlap or any thing that can steer that conversation in a direction to something fruitful for both of them? Or are they just too separate for those voices to be able to meet in the middle, so to say, in quotation marks?
Yeah, so this is definitely a question that I get often about this about this paper. And it's an issue that I take quite seriously. Like, I think it is a real and important problem. I don't think that there's no common ground. I think, so I sort of gesture at this towards the end of the paper. I think that there are ways for psychiatry to take these sorts of perspectives seriously, and in some cases even take them on board, even if sort of there are going to be these cases where, you know, productive dialogue just breaks down because people are not interested in engaging in a productive dialogue with one another. And I think sort of partly because of the power differential that you've pointed to, where it seems like the psychiatrists have a lot of the power in these sorts of processes. Like, it is incumbent on them, I think, to do everything they can to take these perspectives seriously, because they're the ones holding all the keys, you know? And they're the ones who, like, at least ostensibly, are committed to being an objective science. That was sort of part of my motivation for framing this paper in terms of objectivity, is like, this is a thing that psychiatrists and those in the DSM process themselves report that they want psychiatry to be an objective science. And often they're sort of, you know, they're using these versions of objectivity, which now in philosophy of science are sort of out of vogue, like this sort of like, well, it's objective insofar as it's value free. And that leads them to think that, you know, that if we include patient perspectives in the process, then like that's values getting into the process, and that's going to undermine its objectivity. That's like an argument that you get a lot. But if we take seriously that like that's just not what objectivity is or what it should be, that actually what's necessary for objectivity is a vast diversity of different valued experiences, then if you wanted scientific objectivity, you have to include these people in the process. Otherwise, you don't get it.
Yeah, I think there are like a million things we could still be talking about. I'm really glad that we have two more sessions at least. But maybe for a final question, personal question, I wanted to know what you think you'll be working on next. What's coming for you in the future?
I just defended my prospectus, my proposal for my dissertation, last week. And roughly the topic of the dissertation is going to be pluralism in psychiatry, which I sort of, partly it grew out of this paper. In the paper, I sort of consider pluralism as sort of, I consider it as a kind of objection, although I don't think it really is an objection to my account, but I'm concerned with how we can have these sort of multiple different interpretations or understandings of the stuff that psychiatry deals with, and have those different interpretations be in a productive dialogue with one another, but without collapsing the distinction between them. And figuring out how to do that is, I think, essential if we're going to get a psychiatry that achieves the kind of social objectivity that I think it should really aim for.
I like that. Pluralism, yay! I'm excited to read that. Well, that is marking the end of our first episode. Thank you very much for taking your time to do this, both of you.
Thanks, Bennett.
Yes, thanks very much. I'm very excited for the next two sessions.
Yeah, for the next session, we're going to talk about Nina's paper. But for now, that's it with the first episode of the Philosophy of Psychiatry mini-series. I hope you as the listener have enjoyed this episode and are coming back for our second episode, which will be published in 2 weeks here on the Philosophy Exchange podcast. If you've liked this episode, you can also let us know about it on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is PhilXChange, where the X is just the letter X. That's all for today. See you next time.